Blog Talk Radio.
Aloha and welcome to Talking Pictures with Paul Booth. I'm your host. Today is a cool, interesting, random day. It's funny. I don't need to tell it on air, but it's a really cool day. We actually had our first call-in guest, but what we're going to do is we're going to say this is take two of Talking Pictures with Paul Booth. So happy to be here. We're going to talk about the film First Match with the writer-director Olivia Newman. And this was a film I saw maybe 10 days or 2 weeks ago on Netflix. And then I just put it in the universe that I wanted to meet this filmmaker. And then randomly I saw a way to message her, and luckily Netflix agreed to let us do this interview. So thank you to them. We appreciate them. One second here. I drink water on air. I want people to feel like we're sitting in a coffee shop hanging out. So it's totally cool. As a guest or listener, grab your tea and water, kick up your feet. I had someone tell me once, that's so unprofessional. You drank water on air. And I said, you know what? If we could meet every guest in a coffee shop, we would. But we have guests in New York and Florida and Seattle and Colorado. And we've just had guests from all over. We're so lucky. So Olivia will be calling in any second now. We're going to get into talking about this film, First Match. So cool. It's on Netflix. You can check it out. Brilliant cinematography. We'll get into that. Well drawn out characters, all those goodies that go into making a film. They're all there. They're all solid. So hold on. We'll bring in our guest and welcome Olivia. Are you with us?
I'm with you. Thanks so much for having me.
No problem. I was just telling the audience how it was just very cool, and I believe in manifesting things with the universe, and so it's always been really cool, and I've always been thankful if I see a film and say, oh, I would love to interview this director, and then if it happens a week or so later that you end up finding a way to message them or their rep, so I thanked the rep and all that, and just welcome to Talking Pictures. Just a couple of things. We're not censored, and also we're not gossip. We're not personal, and then we don't go A to B to C. So we do just,
okay.
Yeah, we want it to be more of like to me. I'm sitting having coffee with you in a coffee shop, and it just so happens that we're recording it and then letting people listen.
Got it.
Yeah, I just can't stand those shows that are like, so then you went to college, then you got married. It's like, oh, really? So you weren't married before high school? We had mentioned it in our little prelim call there, but First Match, my first question does have to be the cliche one. I'd love to hear just your version of the synopsis and then why this story.
My version of the synopsis. Well, First Match is about a teenage girl from Central Brooklyn who, upon running into her father, who's just been released from prison, tries to find a way to reconnect with him and does so by joining the all-boys wrestling team at her high school and taking up a sport that he excelled at in high school. So it's about a girl who's trying to connect with her dad and trying to connect with her dad through a sport that they both love. The way I got there was a very kind of windy and long road. I became interested in the phenomenon of girls wrestling on boys' wrestling teams when I was working for a film distributor called Women Make Movies. I, prior to going to graduate school for my MFA in directing and screenwriting, I worked at Women Make Movies for several years. It was a distributor that distributed mostly documentaries that were directed by and about women, and I was in the marketing department, so I helped promote and market these documentaries. And one of the films that I worked on was a film called Girl Wrestler, and it was about a girl who was wrestling boys in middle school in Texas. And at the time, there was a law in Texas that prohibited girls and boys from participating in co-ed sports starting in high school. So she was sort of facing her last year of competitive wrestling because she knew she'd kind of end up on the bench in high school. There weren't enough girls wrestling at the time for her to be able to, you know, join a girls wrestling team. They just, it just, there weren't any. So that was sort of my foray into this world of girls wrestling. And I just got interested in, I just got interested in, like, you know, who are these girls that choose to wrestle and why, and what is it like to be a teenage girl wrestling boys? It's something that I would never have had the courage to do. And so I started researching. Yeah.
Well, you know, what I had mentioned about our school was it was girls against girls. There was never girls against boys. But in practice, it was weird because you are having to push a girl around, throw her down.
Oh, because you practice with the girls.
Yeah. So there was,
got it.
You know, the girl, what it was there was like six girls, but if one was ever sick or injured or they would partner up with a guy, and
right.
So you would kind of be in that position where it's like, I don't put my hands on women, you know?
Right,
so
yeah.
The coaches would be like, that's good. So that's where it was kind of like, that was, I just remember those awkward moments of like, you have to get
totally.
On top of a girl and put her in a headlock. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, totally. And I think, I've heard this from, you know, from both sides of it, you know, it's, I think it presents challenges for the, you know, for both the boys and the girls who are wrestling each other. And I, you know, when I first got interested in it, I thought, you know, well, God, you know, what is it like to get on a mat with a boy? And it's, you know, there's nothing is off limits. It's a full contact sport.
Right.
And when I was doing my research, because I eventually decided when I started graduate school and was writing scripts, and I kept writing these characters of girl wrestlers in all of my scripts. And eventually decided, okay, I'm going to get this out of my system. I'm going to make a short film about a girl wrestler, and I'll do the research. I'll learn about the sport. I'll finally kind of get this passion out of my system. And so I went out and started interviewing girls who are wrestling on boys' teams in New York City, because that's where I was. That's where I was going to school. I went to Columbia University. And so I started interviewing girls who are on boys teams and their parents and coaches, and, you know, just tried to get an understanding of what the experience was like. And I expected to hear lots of stories about, you know, boys refusing to wrestle girls or having issues with it, and the girl, you know, and girls feeling uncomfortable and all these things. And I did, you know, I did hear a lot about that, but what I found was that the girls would initially kind of encounter that when they joined the team, a lot of resistance from the boys, not wanting to practice with them or feeling like they didn't belong there. And once the girls sort of proved themselves as being really committed to the sport and athletic and you know, working just as hard, eventually all of that stuff sort of went to the wayside and they became just part of the team. And, you know, it was, the girls would often refer to the other wrestlers on their team as their brothers. And, you know, I heard lots of kids talk about how they were just, you know, it was like being part of one big family. And I didn't, you know, I didn't want to ignore that reality that seemed to be a, like a recurring thing that I would hear from these wrestlers. And so that's really what inspired, eventually when I evolved the short into a feature film, I really wanted to focus on this girl who sort of inadvertently finds a family on this boys' wrestling team, even though she's chasing what she thinks is a real family and trying to connect with her father. She sort of accidentally stumbles upon a family on this wrestling team.
Yeah, I really liked the layered themes and there being so much to it. I actually started it too late at night that I ended up finishing it the next day because I caught on right away that it was going to be layered and that the writing was so strong that I didn't want to do it as one of those where you're just kind of dozing off. And I thought, okay, it's not just cliche here, cliche there. There's going to be some cool things here. And I liked the way, for me, if I was reviewing the film, I liked the way there was, I don't want to say isolation, it's not giving anything away, but that wrestling is one of the few sports, like judo, whatever, where I know a lot of wrestlers that say the reason why they like it is because only you are responsible for the win or the loss. Football players can say the quarterback fumbled or threw an interception. Soccer players can say the guy didn't pass it. Basketball, but wrestling is you won or you lost. And that's what I really liked about was that life is your choices. You win or lose, or you just enjoy the journey and know it is. And that's why I really thought it was great what you have done with the characters and what goes on with the girl, and it being a backdrop of wrestling. And once I did the research and saw that it was a short, I thought, oh, this is really interesting, because to expand that out, of course, we had mentioned you got to, so did you premiere at South by Southwest and then just get picked up by Netflix, or did you play other festivals as well?
No, so, just a couple things. One is just to add on to what you're saying about wrestling, you know, what I unlike boxing, where it's really just you in the ring and you're in, you know, and it's just, you know, that you're a one person team. What I love about wrestling is, yes, it's just, you know, you on the mat that's responsible for the win or the loss, but you are also beholden to your team, because when you're playing duels, you know, each match affords a point to the team, and that's what, you know, brings the team to finals. And so I like this idea that everything was on, you know, the whole win or loss was on her shoulders, but she was also responsible to her team. And she had to think about other people. And that's something that, you know, her father struggles with, is he's in survival mode and having to think about, you know, his own survival, and isn't as good at thinking about, you know, the sort of bigger picture and his bigger responsibilities to, you know, to his family. So that's something that, you know, Mo has to learn and learns through wrestling, is how to be responsible and how to be accountable to other people. In terms of the film's release, so we premiered at South By. The film was financed by Netflix, so they came in and paid for the whole thing.
Okay. So
The way it works is that not all of their original films will have a festival premiere, but we were very fortunate that they wanted to premiere it at a festival. So we premiered at South By, and then they released it 2 weeks later. And they do that on purpose, because they want to use the sort of press that's coming out of the festival premiere to then encourage people to go watch it online. And they don't want to wait too long to release it, because the minute that people are reading about it, they want them to feel like they're going to be able to go and watch it really soon and not forget about it, you know, months later. So it was great. You know, South By was a great place to release it, because it already had distribution, and we don't have, you know, the film, it's an all-black cast, and we don't have huge stars in our film. So there isn't like a big industry drive to go see the movie, you know, for the stars or for the opportunity to purchase it. And so premiering at a festival like South By, which is really about sort of discovering new voices and independent filmmaking, felt like a really great place to launch it.
Well, yeah, I mean, if the deal's already done to be going to a festival, that's great. I mean, I think and the film earns it, and so that's what's cool. So when I saw that, because see, I know that Netflix, when their name is in the corner, the little some people don't notice that. I understand when we Netflix, we're constantly, oh, wait, I want to see this. Oh, wait, but this is trending. And I know those little things in the corner mean that Netflix made it. So I assume that Netflix made it. I just didn't want to ask the business side. But I thought that was you're our first made by Netflix film. We've been fortunate to have a number of guests they having their premiere to Netflix or Amazon or iTunes, Redbox. But that's what I liked was you had mentioned documentaries. There was a Duplass Brothers documentary called Wild, Wild Country that last month we were supposed to have the directors on, and then last minute schedules changed. But so I just thought it was cool because Netflix is just doing so well with strong indie characters and voices. And I remember when they started, their draw was they had rare foreign films and documentaries. And that's in the filmmaking community, it was like, oh, you can see these French films that aren't in libraries. And so it's on Netflix. What's Netflix? And so now I really like that they're doing indie voices and documentaries and,
they're really filling a gap in the independent, in the independent world. This film, the script went through the Sundance Screenwriters and Directors Labs. We got grants, like high-profile grants from San Francisco Film Society and Tribeca Film Institute and Adrian Shelley Foundation and lots of, support from the independent film community, and we sort of did all the thing that you're supposed to do to finance your first independent feature of like getting support from all of these different places. And yet, we'd go to meeting after meeting with production financiers who would say, we love the script, this feels really timely, but it's too risky. And the sort of subtext was, this isn't financeable with an all-black cast. And that was, really disheartening to me and my producers. We felt like, why isn't our story important enough to take this chance on? And so it was really exciting when Netflix, they came on board within a week of reading the script. And they were incredible creative partners. They really gave us, total creative control. Their notes on cuts were always really smart but not invasive. And then they've put a lot, they put a lot into the release and trying to get us, press pretty widely. So they really have, it's like right now at a time when like Khan is saying we won't allow Netflix films in competition, and there's been sort of this, Steven Spielberg made a comment about how Netflix films should not be eligible for Oscars, and it's disheartening because I feel like, Netflix allowed this movie to get made in a way that more traditional routes would not have. And I think this is a story that's just as important to tell as, the next Spielberg film. And I love Spielberg films. But it feels like there's this backlash against Netflix because they're a streaming platform, but that's, thank God that exists for filmmakers who are trying to tell stories that cannot be made in the more traditional route.
Well, right. I want to ask you a few things about that tie into the film. Of course, you use the film as the background about Tribeca and Sundance. But what I wanted to comment on what you said with Netflix was we had Rachel Morrison on for Mudbound, and she came on like 2 weeks before Mudbound came out. So it was kind of weird because it was the only interview I'd ever done where I hadn't seen the film. And
interesting.
Yeah, and then on top of that, her next film was Black Panther, which was, of course, the first blockbuster with, I say non-white, I don't like saying black. I don't see color, so it's always hard for me to say anything. But with Mudbound, so when she got the Oscar nomination, then it was kind of trippy because I'd get people being like, how'd you get Rachel Morrison? And I was just like, her rep asked me to interview her, it wasn't like I went on this odyssey, like Lord of the Rings and, Rachel's just this terrible person. And then someone talked her into it. It was just like, you know, those sometimes those things in the industry where people get so into that hype or whatever that it's just like, no, sometimes it's just about putting your, you know, like my uncle says, just wake up in the morning and put your pants on and you'll be amazed what happens. and you might get knocked down, but just get up the next morning. Very interesting because I think there is that, like you said, I wasn't going to bring up the Spielberg thing. And again, on the show, all opinions of the guests are the guests and of what I say, and we're, you know, our team of producers of the show is just filmmakers that love movies. We really started this because we just wanted the show to be like a networking party. We just thought we know too many filmmakers around the country and world that we shouldn't be bringing them together, even if it's just to hear about each other's films. So to be talking with someone who had a film on Netflix, and then of course we've had AFI graduates, NYU graduates, we've had guests, not because of us, but afterwards went through the Sundance Lab. So I'm interested, what was it like to have a film, and what is the Sundance Lab? What was it like for the film and you as a filmmaker?
The Sundance Labs feels like kind of was a real turning point for me as a filmmaker. I went to Columbia, as I mentioned, for graduate school, and I started submitting, I submitted a script to the Sundance Labs before I had graduated that was, now looking back, I realized was like a little bit too early to be submitting a script to them. And I got rejected, but that rejection was great because it put me, I got a personal rejection from one of the people who worked at the institute, and that began a relationship between us. So for every deadline, she would touch base with me and check in, see if I had a new draft of that script to submit or something new. And I'd say this, you know, for any filmmakers who are listening, because I think it's really like these labs can be really important for opening doors and for kind of getting that stamp of approval on your project that makes other people take notice. And I, you know, you sometimes think of a rejection as kind of a setback, but it was actually, that was like the first door that opened to having a direct relationship with the Institute. So that when I eventually did, and I took those, every deadline for the labs was like a good, you know, I would set my goals, like I want a new draft ready for the next deadline. And if it wasn't ready, I would hold off and wait until I really felt like it was in the best possible place. And so before I resubmitted my to the labs with First Match, I went through another lab in Mexico called Sine Qua Non, which I recommend to everybody. You spend 2 weeks in Mexico, you get incredible feedback from the woman who runs it is Christina Lazzariti. She takes your film and your script and breaks it apart and finds the heart of the story and gives you just the most amazing feedback. And so coming off of that lab, I then rewrote a draft and submitted it, and that's the draft that got me into the labs. As far as like the actual experience, the screenwriting lab is 5 days, I believe, 5 or 6 days, and you have 6 one-on-one meetings with advisors, and those meetings are about 2.5 hours long, and you spend that time they just, you know, take apart your script and give you whatever feedback they have for you. So it's this very intense, you know, few days where you're at the resort, and some of the meetings you have are the most amazing and enlightening meetings. And some of them feel awful because I think, you know, as with anyone who watches your film or reads your script, some people will totally get the film that you're trying to make or we're trying to make, and other people, it doesn't vibe, or they have different tastes, and so they might be pushing you in a different direction than you want to go. And so it's a lot about just receiving all this information from these incredibly accomplished and skilled writers, and then trying to filter what feels right and what, you know, what direction you want to go and what direction you don't want to go. So that's the screenwriting lab. And then after that, you are given a month to rewrite your script. And if you want to apply for the director's lab, then you have to have a new script to submit. Ah. So you submit a new script. Right. And the director's lab is by invitation only, and generally it's the screenwriting. It's, if you've gone through the screenwriting lab, that you're invited to submit to the directing lab. So and then they take 8 directors through the directing lab. The directing lab is 5 weeks, and you spend 4 of those weeks shooting scenes from your script. You can fly out 3 actors, and then they cast other actors for other roles locally. You get a small crew. You get a DP and, you know, an AD and a script supervisor, and then a bunch of PAs who wear lots of different hats. And you shoot these, you know, you shoot 4 or 5 scenes from your film, and then you get them critiqued by an army of advisors, and the advisors change every week, and it's amazing. It's like camp for filmmakers. And then in the 5th week, you have another round of screenwriting meetings. So you do like a second screenwriting lab in the last week. So it's incredibly intense. And like the screenwriting lab, you're just getting tons and tons of feedback. And the advisors for the directing lab, you have advisors who are cinematographers, editors, directors, writers. So you're getting feedback on, you know, all aspects of directing and writing. It's amazing. Well, I can't. And then the other thing is, you get, you know, once you've gone through their labs, they support your project until it's made, meaning you can have phone conversations with them when you're trying to crew up. They can help connect you to crew. In fact, I had a meeting with Rachel Morrison about shooting First Match because of an introduction through the Sundance labs. And Mudbound, unfortunately, the schedule conflicted with my shoot schedule. So I have funny place
Rachel?
In my heart for Mudbound, because I'm at the one hand was like, you know, you
don't
took
you
Rachel Morrison
Rachel?
Away from me. On the other
she's
hand,
so,
I think
so
she
awesome.
Made the right decision.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just thought she was such a great person. That's so cool that you were going to possibly work with her. I think we were supposed to do 20 minutes, and we did like a 55-minute podcast, because it was just like, we just kept being new things. Yeah, I'm so glad. And also on a
side
note,
it's funny when I think about those early conversations we were having, because, you know, Dee's film was originally going to shoot in the spring, and then it got pushed, and so the timing was going to maybe work out, because my film was a summer shoot, and then it got pushed. But Rachel ended up getting nominated for an Oscar, so I think she definitely made the right decision. And I ended up getting to work with Ashley Connor, who I love and adore and can't imagine anyone else shooting my movie. So I think it all worked out. It would have been something different with Rachel, I'm sure, wonderful as well. But it was, you know, I'm really happy with how things fell into place.
On your film, the textures were so amazing.
Oh my god!
That was something
and
that I really liked.
Yeah, and Ashley, my DP, is just she's a beast. I call her. She's just unbelievable with her handheld shooting. She shot the whole film with a 60-pound camera on her shoulder, running alongside the actors, like long takes. She'd never, you know. In a very, very hot July in New York City, I can't imagine having shot it with anyone else now.
Well, it's such an interesting, now that I've seen the film, and everyone definitely still check this out. Now that you're looking at the film, thinking of mixing the influence of Sundance with New York, with Columbia, with that you were there, because I love when you see a film and you can just tell that there's just a little bit of the director just has that one up on experience of the place. Like, you have those directors like Alexander Payne, that movie The Descendants, which he made in Hawaii on my home island. Obviously, he's not from there, but it's the most realistic portrayal of our island you will ever see. And it always amazed me how, like, a guy who is Greek and grew up in Nebraska made the most authentic film about Hawaii ever made. So knowing that, you know, you went to Columbia and you knew New York and had been to New York, could capture that gritty feeling and that that tension that seems to be in the air in New York. And I don't just mean since I only went there after 9/11. So I, of course, there's a tension. And when you're, once they realize you're not a New Yorker, we won't get into the political, all that. But for me and my experience, I understood why there was a tension towards me, or just that general New York tension. I always say my favorite guy is a New Yorker, and the meanest people I've ever met are New Yorkers. So it's like, I love what a yin yang. Well, you know, it's that whole, like, a cop one time didn't know I had my iPod on or off. He thought it was on, and I asked him for directions, and I named this street wrong, and he started calling me names because he thought my headphones had music on. And I so wanted to turn around and be like, is that to protect and serve what you just called me? But I didn't know a lawyer in New York, and I didn't have anybody to bail me out. But I just thought, wow, buddy, like, I insulted you by asking for directions. Like, how about you come to Hawaii and ask where something is? So anyways, I love New York. That's what I'm saying. Like, one of my favorite people in the world is a New Yorker in Queens that grew up there. So so thank you for explaining all that about the Sundance Lab, because I've always, I've of course, the illustrious people that have went through there, and we see all people as just people. We've had celebs on the show, and we've had Oscar nominees, and we love when people can just make film about making films. And we also like, of course, learning about the guests. So thank you for sharing that. Now, what I would love to know is for you, and I don't mean personal, but for you, I guess it's kind of personal. For you as a person, you're talking to me, and you have Sundance. You did work with Tribeca. You won stuff at South by Southwest, and you have Netflix. And I don't hear an arrogant egomaniac on the phone. So what centers you and keeps you away from the fact that you were going to shoot with Rachel Morrison? You probably met God knows who at the Sundance Lab, but you're still just talking like you're a normal filmmaker.
I'm just a normal struggling filmmaker. I mean, you know, I didn't make any money off of this movie. I'm trying to figure out how to build a sustainable career, just like, you know, anybody who's trying to get their first feature made. And I shouldn't say I didn't make any money off this movie. I made a salary, but it was a very independent film. You know, our budget was very, very lean. We made it for as little as possible, and having Netflix attached didn't mean that the budget changed. We gave them what we thought we could make the film for, and they said yes to that. But that doesn't, you know, and going to the Sundance Labs, like, you know, people who go to the Sundance Labs are trying to get their first features made, and this is a big door that opens for them. So I think I'm the only difference between me and anybody who's listening to this who hasn't made their first feature is just that they haven't made a first feature yet. That's, you know, that's, we're all in the same kind of struggle, and it continues to be. It's not, you know, I'm finishing up my next script. I'm reading stuff to try to figure out if I can attach myself to something else to direct. I'm having to compete with people who have more experience than me. So it's like the struggle just continues. Like, the first one is getting that boulder up the hill of, like, I need to get that first feature made so I at least have that experience in my pocket, so that people don't look at me as somebody who's not made a feature yet, which has its own sort of its own roadblocks. And now I'm just someone who's made, oh, but you've only made one feature, and it was an indie feature. So it's like, no matter what stage you're at, there's always, like, some place higher that you have to aspire to. I think that keeps everyone who's in this field grounded, because it's, you know, nothing is ever handed to you. It's a daily struggle.
No, I really like what you're saying, because that's where we, when we first started this podcast, we made a list of everything that we disliked about the business and said, this is what we won't do. It was like no gossip, no talking about scandals, no, like, because we were all, except for one of our producers, all of us had produced a couple of features. I had a couple of things in Hollywood Video and Blockbuster before video stores left. I have 4 things on Amazon Prime that are just such awful B action movie, horror movie stuff. I don't know how they're even on Prime. I don't even tell people the titles, but it's like you're saying, there's that part of it where it's like, okay, at first it was, okay, you've only made one. Then it was, you've only made two. Then it was, well, you only have 4. And it's like, okay, well, I guess it really is just always going to be a struggle. Like, no, I'm not saying like, I'm not talking about me personally, but I'm talking about, I think of the people who are trying to, like, you could totally understand this when you said we're all just doing it. Cause I'm always saying that, with guests, when some guests will tell me, oh, but my film didn't, your guest last week played Sundance. And I say, no, we're just doing it. I produced my first national release, did it with a company on the Universal lot. Flash forward 5 years later, I'm at Blockbuster and I'm looking through the $1.99 bin and my movie is in it. And I just thought, all that work, I was actually, I could go to the gate and my name was at the Universal gate. I was young and in my 20s, thought I had it made. I said, I walked around the lot with no one questioning me. And I'm sitting here looking at it with $1.99 in the trash bin, basically. And my best friend looked at me. He looked at me and he said, you know what? There's a million filmmakers outside this door that wish they had a movie in this bin.
Totally.
And it just gave me such perspective. It was like, whoop, back to ground zero. I'm like, you know what? You're so right. I should just be glad that Blockbuster's even trying to get this movie out of their building. So I totally can relate to that. And I love this show. To me, I always feel like I get these little free master's classes because I just thought this podcast came about because I was in a bad car wreck. I could no longer do the hours of producing films or consulting or whatever. And I didn't know what to do. And my friend just said, well, you know what? You know films, you've made films, and you're a motor mouth, so do a podcast. And I never thought your episode 292, and we have episodes already booked through like end of July. And so to me, I just thought, hey, you know what? He's right. Like, I can talk with filmmakers, and when they talk about there was no money for Crafty, I know that means you had to eat a big breakfast. And, you know, I know the trenches of distribution and here having a deal fall through or getting a deal. And if you're on your second or third time, wondering why your deal was way better on your first than your third. Or, you know, like you said, you had a salary. And again, this is nothing against Netflix. I'm talking about me. I happen to work with a director that just thought it was all too timely to not share royalties. So I might have 4 things on Prime, but I don't get royalty checks. So,
well, I think it's important to demystify the whole making of a movie and what it means and then what the outcomes are, because I certainly you know, 5 years ago when I was in graduate school and applying for these things and seeing filmmakers who were just, you know, just that one step further in their career who were getting into the Sundance Labs and then premiering their film at a big festival, like, to me that seemed like, okay, well, that means, you know, their career is made. And I remember when I got into the Sundance Labs telling my brother, this means my movie's going to get made. Like, films that go to the Sundance Labs get made. And it's, you know, that ended up being true, but it wasn't because of the Sundance Lab that my movie got made. That was an important step, and it opened some doors, but ultimately, you know, and the script got better because of the labs, but ultimately the film got made because of the producers who were by my side and and Netflix who came in and my producer who had a relationship with Netflix, and, you know, and Sundance, of course, was part of it, but that wasn't like that wasn't the golden ticket. That was one of many, many, many things that sort of fell into place. And I have friends who went through the Sundance Labs who are still struggling to get their films made, and I have every confidence that they will, but, you know, everyone's path is a different windy and crazy road. So I, you know, I always like if there's an opportunity to sort of break down what all of these steps were and how it came together and then what it looks like on the other side is like, well, now you have to struggle to get the second film made and get a paid job. It doesn't, it's not like jobs are then just handed out at the finish line, you know? So the struggle continues. And of course it helps to have that feature under your belt, but then the struggle is how to get the second one made and what, and then what is the right next one? And are you going to make, you know, you don't want to just do anything just to get a paycheck, but you also have probably been supporting yourself in really weird ways to get this first deal made.
Of course.
You know, so you're like kind of desperate for some cash. And so it's, you know, just break sort of demystifying all of it would have been, I look back and think like, I wish somebody had broken it down for me. So I had like, my expectations were a little different.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, this, cause Sundance Lab is obviously with people saying Redford and then that, you know, that great book, The Sundance Kids, it's like, there just has to be a point where it's like, they wouldn't do it and nothing against them where it's like Sundance Lab, but you're not the next Paul Thomas Anderson. Because there's only one Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, or there's only one Tarantino, or the only thing you have is you. I remember when I happened to get a meeting with the dean of the USC Film School through a mutual friend, and she sat me down. I was like 20, and I remember sitting at her desk, and I was just in awe because there's like signed posters of alumni, and there's pictures on her desk of her and George Lucas. And she just literally said to me, she's like, you know what? She's like, we don't need Spielbergs. We don't need George Lucas. We don't need John Singleton. All you have is that you grew up on a little island in Hawaii.
Right.
She's
sure.
Like, that's what we need. And I just remember it floored me because I thought she was going to have this big, you know, like we said, demystifying of, oh, this school, Caleb Deschanel went here, and John Singleton, and Ron Howard, I mean, Ron Howard dropped out, but they still say he, books and stuff say he went there, I'm so glad that you said that, because part of, we also use this show in our own way, just amongst producers, to hopefully that people walk away knowing that the battle continues, and that you just actually have to love it. And this is a good way to just show that there is people, whether they're trying to get that $100 million or that $100, there's still going to be roadblocks. Just maybe the guy getting $100 million already has a pool and you're swimming at the gym that you pay a membership for. So, with your film, what I just wanted to say in closing was, we really appreciate the show, my producers, I run everything by them, and myself. We really appreciate that you were open to just a random message and that you actually asked Netflix, and we thank you for that. I had a very enjoyable time having you on, you know, my grandma used to always tell me, just ask. The worst somebody can do is say no. And this was really
like, that's a good lesson for filmmaking.
Oh yes. Oh yeah.
You'll hear no about 1,000 times before you get
yes.
your yes.
and
even those people who are telling you no could end up being champions, you know? Like getting my first rejection from the labs was like a huge help, actually. So
keep
you never know.
Letters. Yes, keep rejection
letters.
Yes, keep
letters. The rejection letter.
Yes.
And ask why, I started get, you know, asking for feedback when I would get, like when I was sending shorts to festivals, the short film First Match, you know, did pretty well in the festival circuit. And then any time I would get a rejection, I would ask the festival, can you give me feedback on why? Just because it's helpful to hear like how these things work and how programming decisions are made and, you know, what was missing in your script that would have gotten it, you know, maybe gotten it a little further. So anyway, those rejections
that's totally brilliant. I love that you did. I love that you're saying to do that. I guess we're in similar ways. I had a friend who would just tell me to keep rejection letters, read them a year later, read them. I ran a student film festival in Hawaii, from 99 to 2003. We rejected these guys. They didn't know how to present that they wanted feedback. So they ended up being where I wanted to give them feedback, but I was too busy. I mean, we had venues on five islands and I didn't have a crew. It was just like, I did everything. And literally at opening night, these guys, they showed up, and at the end of the festival, they said, okay, now this is just the core of my judges and filmmaking buddies. We're hanging out. We're in the theater. They literally walked in and they said, okay, we really want feedback, and who's willing to stay and watch our film? And I was and everybody was just like, who are these guys? I said, excuse me. They go, you turned us down. And I said, oh, you know what? I said, literally, I do everything. I turned you down because I also go to college and have two jobs. And I said, I wasn't being elusive. I said, but just because you're here, I was like, let's turn on the projector. I said, you guys want to give them feedback? And we sat down and we ended up having this like hour long conversation with them. And I just remember thinking, like, could you really show up at AFI and be like, hey, I want the jury to sit and watch my film? I just admired that. I thought, you know what? Yeah, we were, I mean, 2 minutes later, we would have already been out the door and having beers and, you know, it was just like, so I just said, hey, if you guys got that kind of guts, we're going to watch your film. So, but thank you, Olivia, so much. I'm going to, last thing. Is there a way to see your short? And if you want to throw out any social media so listeners can follow you and keep up with your career.
Yeah, so the short film is on my website, olivianewman.com, on my work page. It's also called First Match. You can also, if you Google First Match short film PBS, I think it's still on the it was on PBS. They're on Film School Shorts was the program it was part of, so I think it's still on PBS. And if you like First Match, I would say rate it and give us your feedback on Rotten Tomatoes and IMDb, because those seem to be the places that where ratings actually matter to people in the industry. A lot of people have been reviewing the film on our Facebook page, which is just facebook.com/firstmatch. And that's great too, because it's, you know, it's fun for us to like to read the feedback. But I think in terms of helping the film get exposure in industry to look at it, the Rotten Tomatoes page is the best place to rate and give feedback. And then Netflix, of course, you can also just find it right on Netflix and put your and leave comments there too. But please spread the word. Hashtag First Match, hashtag Netflix is what we ask people when they comment on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. If you use those hashtags, that would be great.
Excellent. Well, again, we appreciate you coming on, and even though it's through Netflix, whatever, you know the name of the show. For new listeners, the people that are going to hear this, www.talkingpicturesla.com is our website. We have the archives on there. We're just based outside LA. We're not only LA filmmakers, or we have stuff from all over. And again, May 1st will be our 300th episode. Olivia, we become anybody who's on the show is welcome back. So
great.
There's ways to Google the show and contact us, unless the guest hangs up and goes, why did I just talk with that fool? we consider it a big family tree. So we're thankful that we've had guests that have come back with their third or fourth film. So I'm definitely going to keep your name on my radar, and congratulations, and have a wonderful afternoon.
Thanks so much. You too. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take
Talk
care.
Talk soon. Okay. Bye. Bye.
Well, that was wonderful, informative, educational, entertaining. What more can you ask for? That's going to do it for me. I'm your host, Paul Booth. To me, another wonderful day. It's always, you know what? It's always a good day. There's no reason why we should say we have a bad day. If we're alive, if we got to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner and have a roof over our head, it's an awesome day. Take care. Oh, yeah. No matter what you do, make sure and watch a good movie today. Aloha.